Okay, so I'd like to talk today a little bit in the context of our Mishnah about the concept of Makos and the requirement of Dayanim for Makos, which we're stating in a very vague way because there are a lot of questions that could come up in that context. First off, so we know that our Mishnah tells us that Dini Mamonos B'Shlosha starts off with a number of concepts which are adjudicated with three panel bezdins, and eventually our Mishnah is also going to talk about 23-person panels, which deal with issues such as Dini Nefashos. So when it comes to Makos, so we see that Makos is a Machlokes, which the Mishnah states, but doesn't explain so much. Right? So in the middle of our Mishnah it says, basically just this, Makos v'shlosha, Mishim v'shvalom, Ruba Esra v'shlosha. So the Machlokes, the Chachamim, the Tanakama, that whether we require three Dayanim for Makos, or we require 23. So as you probably had a chance to see, the Gemara talks about this Machlokes and what is at the core. But even before getting to that, let's just talk more generally to get a little bit of a background for the concept. So clearly there is a question here as to how we should categorize Makos. Right? And we know that some things get 3 and some things get 23. So why would you say that Makos is in one category or the other? You don't necessarily have to only refer to what the Gemara is going to address in this context, because there are other components that are worth highlighting as well. Why would you say one or the other? If we know, okay, we have certain things that go to the 3 panel and certain things that go to the 23 panel, so what would your instinct be? If I had to ask you without the Mishnah, where would you put Makos? Shmuley?
I'd say something like a capital crime versus a more petty or low-level crime. Something that's much more serious, we're going to take to a basis of 23 versus something that's much less serious is not. So where does Makos fall in that? Is it...
Okay, so you're saying that essentially that's the structure you seem to perceive in the Mishnah, that everything is a question of seriousness, really a question of degree, and that certain things, like just to overgeneralize, we'll say, okay, so monetary issues, they get 3 dayanim, and life or death crimes, capital crimes, get 23 dayanim. So apparently we see a level 10 severity gets the 23 panel, a level 1 severity gets a 3-person panel, and Makos level offenses, let's assume for argument's sake, are somewhere in the middle. We'll call them a level 5. So where does that go? Is that just how do we assign this basically quantitative judgment of how serious are these mid-level offenses? Maybe that's the question. Okay, Jacob?
I think it might be just like how detailed the laws are. Something like it's more clear-cut, you only use 3 judges, to be easier to determine, as opposed to something that's more complicated, you might need more communication, so you never need more people.
Do you feel that that's really the case, though? I mean, theoretically, you could have said that way. But do you feel like, in terms of complexity, that monetary issues are less complex than, let's say,
Shabbos
issues?
There's more clear-cut laws when it comes to something like death. You know, we're supposed to try to acquit the person, and so therefore you have to really...
So, but let's separate out what you're talking about. You say you're supposed to try to acquit the person, as the Mishnah explains. You're saying, so therefore, we're putting more dayanim on because, on the one hand, the weight of the life or death atmosphere, and together with that, the requirement in the Torah to try to do whatever you can to make sure we don't have to take that step, so that brings in more people. But I don't know if the issue inherently becomes more complicated, like we need more insights and more perspectives. One could have argued, especially if you deal with any monetary cases, that they tend to often be very complex and need a lot of attention to nuance and to detail.
I like to think the complexity of the situation more along the lines of the complexity of the ruling.
But even that, the ruling is a function of the complexity. It's more a question of the weight of the consequences, maybe. Life or death, maybe we should say, is a very severe impact. And therefore, we don't deal with that except with a lot of people on board, while Mummus is maybe less than that. Okay?
I don't think this is with everything that is 3, but many of the things can be accomplished through 1 judge.
Right.
So that would not work for something like 23. So I guess the question would be, be, makos, where does that, is that categorized as something that is so, is beyond being able to be done by one judge that everyone can trust?
So you're introducing a whole new factor here. Right? You're saying that basically three is really one. Often. Not always, but maybe three is a way of saying that one could do it, while 23 is really absolutely 23. So our scale for where makos should fit is it something that has an absolute minimum, or is it something which theoretically one person could do themselves? Maybe. Maybe. I'm thinking of a few other details. Any other comments? Any other thoughts? Yes, are you?
I think this is something that the Gemara brings up, but is, I guess, if makos is similar to the death penalty, then that mm-hmm. should be something that's more dinin nefashos. If it's something
okay.
more like a knas, then it's something more like dinin mamos.
Okay, so that's definitely something that Gemara's introduced, as you point out. But even before we get to that, let's try to clarify that a little bit. Now, first of all, when you say knas, so you have to sharpen your language a little bit, right? Because we know that knas, so is only one of the many different categories that we use three for, and some things are not properly termed knas. So we use knas to distinguish between punitive fees and straight mamon. So that's not necessarily a good term for the whole category in its totality. But how else might we say, so why should one get one category and one get the other category? No? Okay, have a comment? So it seems like one issue is that, well, what's one difference? What differences are there between, let's say, a monetary ruling and the capital ruling? Sammy?
The punishments.
Okay, so maybe you'll say that a monetary ruling is not by its very nature necessarily a punishment. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Right? Maybe it's a knas, which maybe we'll see as some type of punishment. But as I just mentioned a minute ago, that doesn't cover the entire category. And not everything in monetary law is a punishment. Now, your point, I assume, being that it might just be a matter of a simple corrective to figure out whose money this is, where does this property go. So maybe that shouldn't really be categorized in something like misa, which is more clearly a punishment. So if you're going to say that, so I would think that makos for sure belongs in the 23 group, right? Which maybe that's the case. Maybe that's Rabbi Shmuel's opinion. Now, why should I say that you should need a larger panel if it's a punishment specifically? Like, how should the factor question whether it's a punishment or whether it's not a punishment, how should that correlate to 3 versus 23? I'm not sure if it does, just to clarify. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Any other thoughts about how to group the two? I think on the surface, one way to group the two, and again, I'm deliberately just doing this without the context of the Gemara and Daf Yud, but one way to phrase things so that you could either put makos in one pile or the other is we could say that there is an inherent chumrah to capital law, right? Life or death is always the most serious issue. So therefore, that requires a panel of a very different nature. And as was pointed out, Jacob pointed out, you need to have a group ready to represent the acquittal team. We have a din that's not necessarily inherent in every other aspect of law. So maybe 23 specifically is a need for dinei nefashos, and therefore makos doesn't have to enter into that category. Maybe we start off with the premise that a beis din is 3, and it's only because of the particular chumrah that's associated with capital crimes that we add on a larger penalty. So makos doesn't have that chumrah, doesn't have inherently in this life or death component, so we don't need 23. That could be one way to say it. Or you could say it a different way. And you could say there's another inherent distinction between money and misa, which might put makos more in the misa category. So Sammy said before, question come up whether it's a punishment or not. That's true. But there's something else that's relevant. And that's reversibility. How severe are the consequences of the mistake? So the death penalty obviously is the definition of irreversibility, and that's one of the reasons why it's such a heated debate in American culture today, because it's a punishment that is irreversible. While a mistake in a monetary ruling, it's a subject we'll get to, we know the details of that, but a mistake in a monetary ruling is theoretically reversible. If we find out later that there was an error, so then you can come back to the panel and deal with it, and if the facts justify it, the judgment could be reversed. Now when it comes to makos, so makos doesn't have the same absolute quality as death, but it's not reversible. The point Tosfos and Masechet Makos points out. I didn't put that in the Maror Makomos, so Tosfos makes that point. That when it comes to mammon, so mammon is chozer. Mammon, one could theoretically just get back there, is no longer. But malchus, once malchus happens, it's done. And it's got to leave its scars. Anyways, a few people commented this morning. It's interesting that, you know, we talk about the concept of the karbanos, nisham leparim sfaseinu, how learning about the karbanos can have the impact of bringing the karbanos. We also talk sometimes about the theoretical power of the Onshin and the Torah. So we saw an action this morning during Seder. There were a few guys who commented that going through some of these Maror Makomos, that they feel that they're not interested in doing any Averis ever again. That the power of just reading about what's involved, not just in Nisa, but in Malchus, can be a big deterrent. So Malchus, even though it's not as absolute as death, but it has a long-lasting psychological and perhaps physical effect too. So if the standard is reversibility, so then we could understand also why we might put Malchus in the Nisa category rather than in the Mammon category. Okay? So far so good? So those are some possible perspectives on why you might categorize one or the other. And as you're familiar, the Gemara in Daf Yud brings in a different concept, which we will come to in a few minutes. But what's also important to put out there at their introduction is that Malchus, so the Mishnah says, Malchus B'Shlosha, that's a very, very broad statement. What are we referring to when we talk about Malchus? First of all, we'll discuss a little bit later that there is a machlokus, perhaps, as to just what even the words mean when we say bishlosha. What has to be done, bishlosha? But before you can get to that, what does makos mean? Right? Makos means getting lashes, but in halacha, so we find that that is utilized in many different contexts. So do they all require shlosha? Are they all treated the same way? So just to begin with, what different usages do we find makos coming up in halacha? How do we find makos involved in halachic sources? Several different ways come to mind. Any thoughts? What does it mean? Makos for shlosha. Makos, what's makos? Where does makos come up in the Torah? Yes?
Lashing somebody is judged to be required to have lashes.
Okay, that's definitely a literal translation. But I think what you mean, the most basic, and what I would like to deal with first, what's the most basic usage? Where do you want to explain? Or you want to...
You're going
to
violate a law.
Sorry? Right, okay. Right, so the case where you are straightforward Chayiv Malchus. So where are you Chayiv Malchus? So as Morty explains, you are basically Chayiv Malchus for every single Aveira in the Torah, without exception, except for many of them. Basically, you find that Malchus is the default punishment. Mark Misachas Makos tells us that if you violate a lav, if you violate the losa, say, so you are chayiv and malchus. And Mark discusses that there's one paradigmatic lav that teaches us some of the principles as to what the parameters of this lav would be. So because of that, we find that there are many, many exceptions. So theoretically, we come from the starting point that any active violation of the Torah law gets you malchus, with many exceptions. So what are some of the exceptions?
Lav Shein Bo Maisa.
Lav Shein Bo Maisa, right? I just already hinted that one when I said active. So if you violate the law in a passive way, so then you don't get malchus. A lot of these, by the way, there's many machlokas and read the details, so I'm just translating them in a simple way right now. So for example, law shein bo maisa, you could argue, does it mean that it's a law that generally doesn't have an action, or it's a law that generally does, but you right now violated it passively? But for now, let's just translate everything simply. So yeah, law shein bo maisa, if there's no action, so that's an exception. What else? If there's some kind of a parallel positive mitzvah that comes afterwards, that's also an exception. What else? Right? So all the chiyuvei misa become exceptions from the malchus category. Anything else? There are a few more. Shmuley? Right, it's also a part of this category. Anything else? There's a few others, Lav Shabaklalos, Lav Nitim Latashluman, which might be similar to Lav Nitek Lasei that Sammy brought up. So we have a lot of exceptions. But the default is the Chi of Malchus. Again, a default which ends up subtracting many, but essentially it's there as the onesh for the Torah when we don't have any reason to exclude it from that group. So on the one hand, Malchus serves as the default onesh for Averis and the Torah. What else does it do?
Doesn't it fall for like batting in Darabana?
Oh, so that's another thing. So then we find that in Darabana, we have a concept called Makas Maris, and that if you violate it in Darabana, so then Chazal also at times imposed the Echid of Malkus. Apparently, Kein Daraisa Tikna, right, that they are following this pattern, that that's the default onesh in the Torah. What else?
Sometimes it's not violating a Darabanan, but it's to be Migdar Milsa.
Oh, okay, so that's another example. You're right, that Chazal may either impose a Chi of Malchus either because they're protecting one of their own laws, or in a way the Torah wouldn't otherwise have required it, but they feel it's necessary for society. That's true also. Right. So we have Makas Darabanan of those types. Shmuley?
Putting Edom Zomim in this category.
So that's, we'll keep that in the first category. Yeah, you know, that the case where the law of the Losana, as the Gemara says, that that's also a law. What else? We also find, Kenny?
I was going to say, maybe from last year, if he just goes back home from again.
Yes.
Use, like, recommendation.
Okay, so that's another very important usage. That we find that maybe we have a concept of kofin. Now we discussed, those of you who were with us last year, so we discussed this at some length. I'll just give a little background. The Gemara Maseches Ksuvos on Daf Pei Vav tells us about the concept of kofin al hamitzvos, that there is the authority given to someone that is in the discussion, but the concept exists theoretically that people can be compelled to perform positive mitzvos. And that compulsion apparently happened through Malchus as well. Maybe there are other ways, maybe there are better ways, but at least one of the ways of compelling people to do mitzvos also involved getting lashes. So that's different. It's different in terms of how many Malchus you get. There, the Gemara has an expression, scary expression, Ashutei Nafsho, that it could extend up to the person no longer surviving the experience. Whether that means aviyat v'chlal or not, that's a whole discussion, but let's say at least up to the front door of that level. And another major difference between that and the malchus that we talked about a minute ago is what? What's the major difference if you talk about the kfiya malchus and the malchus that we just referred to? Well, before and after, right? That basically, malchus that we were talking about a few minutes ago is a punishment. The malchus of kfiya are not punitive. And, in fact, we discussed last year that there were some who maintained that you only give those malchus while it's still possible to correct the situation. So let's say, for example, if you assume, like some Rishonim do, that it's only relevant to a positive mitzvah, somebody refusing to do a positive mitzvah, so the whole point of these malchus is to try to encourage him to do the positive mitzvah. And because it's basically a correctable situation, the individual could still decide, okay, I'll do the mitzvah, so that's why you do it, and if not, not. So if it's a mitzvah whose time has already passed, so then those malchus would not be employed. Or, according to the Rishonim who say you use it even for an avera, it would be an avera that's ongoing and could stop, but if it's an avera that's mamish in the past, that concept's also not going to have a role. So this is very different than the makos of an onesh. And the makos of an onesh happen after the fact, while the makos alluded to in the Gemara and Suvis are specifically before the fact, or during the fact, while the Avera or Bitl Mitzvah is still going on and can be corrected. So that presumably has many different rules. The whole concept is coming from a different direction. So it sounds like that's probably not what we're including in this context, right? We say, Makos B'Shosha, Hasvarid Osenes, we're talking about the first type, Makos that are there as an Onesh for an Avera that is Chayiv Malkus, and not Malkus that are given as an inducement to do mitzvos, presumably. But that difference, the fact that they both exist, certainly worth noting.
There's also a type of makos that's done as a replacement for karis.
Yes, exactly. So that's also what I was looking for, is that we find that makos also exists as a stand-in for other onshin, for onshin which perhaps are more severe. So on the one hand, it could play a role for chiyuve misa as well, right? Even though theoretically, a chiyuv misa is an exception from a chiyuv malchus. Or lav hanitan lasharis misas bezdin is one of the cases where you don't have malchus. But it could have a role for a chiyuv misa as well, as we'll see in a few minutes. But also, the Mishnah says, and Malchus, as Arya points out, that kol chayvei krisus shenilgu nifteru bidei krisusam. That somebody who's chayv krisus, who's chayv karis for something, if he is receiving, if he's going to receive Malchus instead, that actually is a good trade, because that will save him from the Chiyuv Karis, which we assume is the most intense onesh. So presumably we'd rather get Malchus, as scary as they may be, than Karis. So this has major historical significance, just to spend a minute or two on a topic that we'll talk about at a much greater length later on, for the Chiddush HaSmicha debate. Have we talked about that at all this year? I remember, so we will get to it head-on, probably when we talk about it around Daf Hey or so, our sugis of smicha, so God willing, we'll talk about the concept of the chiddush of smicha then, but just to give a one-minute version now, so we know that we assume that we don't have smuchim, bizman hazeh, and we don't have any ordained judges. And the reason is because in order to be a samuch, you have to have a direct link from Moshe Rabbeinu, and that link was broken. So nowadays, there's nobody who receives smicha in a direct chain from Moshe Rabbeinu. So there was an effort about 500 years ago, to revive the smicha. It was known as the Chiddush HaSmicha controversy, or the Chiddush HaSmicha discussion. And it's based on the ruling of the Rambam, which appears in the Perash HaMishnayis, and also in Mishnah Torah. We have the whole sugya, and we'll get it inside with all the proper sources, but just to allude to it now, the Rambam had a chiddush about chiddush. The Rambam innovated this idea that it's possible, even at a later date, for the Rabbanim and Eretz Yisrael to get together and do something to bring smicha back to life. So, because of that ruling of the Rambam, there was an effort to do that in the 1400s, and that was a topic of great controversy for a lot of reasons that we'll go through. It was located in Tzfat, which itself is a question, why not all of Eretz Yisrael, but the Rabbanim of Tzfat attempted to revive the smicha, and among those who got the new smicha was the Mechaber, who was the author of the Shulchan Aruch. So today, to get our version of smicha, you have to pass tests in the Shulchan Aruch. I don't know what the Mechaber had to pass in order to get smicha, but he was the in-between smicha program, so we have our smicha program, which is different than Moshe Rabbeinu's smicha program, but the Chiddush smicha program, so the Mechaber was one of them who received smicha. But it was a topic of major debate, and we'll get into this, that the Maribe Rav was one who was advocating the bringing back of smicha, and the Malbach argued against it. We'll get into those details, but what was the motive? Why were they so vibrant that they wanted to start the smicha again? So we're able to live nowadays in 2015. We don't have smicha and nobody's really crying about it at the moment. So why did they feel then that there was such a need for smicha? Because, because this was happening, I said the 1400s before, this is really, you know, the early 1500s, this is happening post-Inquisition. This is happening after many Jews were pressured to engage in Avodah Zarah. Right? Many Spanish Jews during the Inquisition were forced to convert, were forced to engage in Avodah Zarah. And the problem is, as we know, Avodah Zarah is Yehari V'Yavol. And so the fact that somebody is forcing you is not an excuse to engage in Avodah Zarah. So they had a lot of Jews who were theoretically Chayiv Karetz because of their involvement in Avodah Zarah. So in order to save these Jews from the Chayiv Karetz, the hope was, let's give them Malchus instead. Kol Chayiv Krisus Shanilku Nifteru Midei Krisusam. That if you'll get Malchus instead, that will excuse you, get you off the hook for your Chayiv Karetz. So this will be, like we said before, a good trade-off for these people. This will be much better than the alternative. So let's bring that back. Because we see in our Mishnah, Makas Bishlosha, so the assumption seems to be that we need something for Malkus that we don't necessarily have in your average modern-day community, and we need Smicha in order to bring that about. That was the premise. Now the premise could be argued on from both sides, that maybe we could do it without that, maybe we can't do it even with that, and that was why it was such a controversy, and better willing we'll get into the details. I always wondered, and I heard, I think the first day of this month, Rashachta gave an introduction to Sanhedrin, anybody there? So I think he mentioned this point also, so I've always wondered about this. I think he mentioned that it is an inherent steer in the whole thing, that the Rambam himself, who was the source for the idea of Chiddush HaSmicha, so the Rambam Shita against the other Rishonim, but the Rambam's opinion is that if somebody violates a Yehari V'Yavol, the three dinim that you're not supposed to violate, even on pain of death, so what happens if you do? Right, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, worship of Avodah Zarah, so you're not supposed to do it. But what happens if you do? So the Rambam's opinion is you're potter, because you're an onus. If somebody forced you to do it, you weren't supposed to give in to the pressure. Okay, even so, but it's still not considered free will anymore. So it's an interesting kind of paradox that you were supposed to resist the pressure, but if you don't resist the pressure, you're still considered to be honest according to the Rambam. Others shown disagree. So it seems like these individuals were not Chayav Karetz according to the Rambam. So the whole premise of Chiddush HaSmicha is based on the Rambam's unique Chiddush, and the Rambam himself probably wouldn't require it. So we'll have to figure that out. It seems to be an inherent steer in the whole concept, but that's the whole premise. But in any event, so this whole idea is reflective of this notion that that's another role that Makos could play, that it could be a stand-in for other onshin. Right? Sorry?
It could be that there are some people who aren't really forced.
Right, I think that might also be the case. I mean, maybe there were some people who didn't rise to the level of complete danusim. Right, that's actually the name for some of them. We're called Anusim, right? So if it's real Anusim, so the Rambam's opinion is that they would be chayav, right? Maybe not everyone involved necessarily rose to that level. So it seems that that's another place in which Makos could be referred to halachically. And to what extent is our Mishnah addressing that kind of Makos, or do the halachos of Makos in general apply to that concept too? That's something we'll also have to figure out. We also find that some type of symbolic malchus, at least, are also invoked in the context of tshuva, even in later generations. In the Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Yom Kippur, and some in the Tafrei Zayin. So there is a discussion of a practice that many had, nowadays you don't see it so often, to give themselves some kind of lashes on Erev Yom Kippur as an act of tshuva. And the Chassam Sofer in the tshuva actually connects these concepts. The Chassam Sofer writes that the idea of kol chayav krisus shenifteru shenilku nifteru midei krisusam, that you can get out of kares through malchus. So the Rambam's opinion is that only works together with tshuva. If you do tshuva for an iser kares and you get malchus, then you get off the hook. So the Chassam Sofer writes, well, why do I need Malkus then? Tshuva works for everything. Right? So if I do tshuva, so I should be excused from my karis also. So the Chassam Sofer suggests that it has to do with the kapara component, that the Mishnah says in Yuma that there are chiluke kapara, there are four different categories of kapara, that there are some averos which, even if you do tshuva, you also have to have something more in order to get atoned. So you'll have to have yisurin also in order to be atoned for a chiyuv karis. So the malchus will play that role. So you do tshuva, that really got you off the hook. And the yisurin part, that's done with the malchus. So the Chasam Sofer says, based on that, you shouldn't really need formal malchus in the sense. It shouldn't matter whether it really counts as malchus and bezdin, if it has the impact of yisurin. So that should accomplish the idea of kol chai v'krisus shenilku. And therefore, that also works in order to explain the practice on Yom Kippur, every Yom Kippur, of self-administered malchus leva bezdin, because the notion is, one's trying to provide the yisurin component in order to complete the picture.
Is it also to physically harm oneself or for somebody else to physically harm somebody?
Yes, that's a good question. How exactly do you address the issue of Chavala? How do you address the issue of Hakka?
That would be why you're doing the basin, because the basin obviously has the right and responsibility to do that, and it's warranted.
Well, maybe obviously. I don't know if it's so obvious. Bezdin sometimes has the authority. You know, you may have to have a Bezdin that we don't necessarily have today.
Right. That's why you want to reestablish Mithras in order to have basin that has.
That is authority. It's hard to do that, except that we find it sometimes happening without that context, but you could be right. So we'll have to, and again, God willing, we'll get into that a little bit more. Okay, so what do we see so far? So we see that whether Makos should be grouped with Misa on the one hand or with lesser issues on the other hand, we saw a couple of reasons to go one way or another, and then we saw a couple of different categories where Makos is invoked in a halachic setting. And therefore, when the Mishnah says Makos Bishlosha, we have a couple questions of what that means. We'll soon have to figure out what it means Bishlosha. But even before that, just what does Makos mean? What type of halachic usage of Makos is being referred to here? I think it is a safe guess that at least it means what was suggested first. It means when one is Chayiv Malkus for a lav. But to what extent do any halachos that are referred to here also apply to other usages of Makos and halacha? That's somewhat of an open question. Okay, so let's try to take a look at how the Gemara on Daf Yud addresses the fact that there is a machlokas between the Chacham and Rabbi Shmuel about whether it is a three-person panel or a 23-person panel. So what does the Gemara say about that? So first, the position of Chachamim, so the Gemara over here in the beginning of Daf Yud, has drushes from Sukkim in order to derive a chiyuv of three people on the panel. But Rabbi Shmuel's opinion that it's 23, so that clearly has some connection to the capital panel, to the Chiyuv Misa panel. But what is that connection based on? So what does the Gemara say? So one possibility is Xer Shava, that's the first suggestion. But what's the second suggestion, which is going to be even more interesting to us? Malkus B'Misa B'Amakom Misa Umedes. So Malkus somehow is a stand-in for Misa. So what exactly does that mean? In what way is Malkus a stand-in for Misa? So here was a dispute in the Rishon. So we have what might amount to three different opinions in the Rishon. And let's try to take a look at them. And then we'll probably have to break for mincha again, and we'll finish this by tomorrow. So, what are the three different opinions? First of all, what does Rashi say? In what way should we say that Malkus wants to be so mad?
Okay, so, yes, are you? For violating a law, for violating the word of God, you should be getting that in every case. However, there's a knas to just get Malkus.
Okay, so Rashi is fascinating, right? And Rashi is really conceptual in nature. We'll see other suggestions are shown in more practical in nature. But Rashi is basically saying that the default onus for violating the Torah really should be Misa. And that on some level, Malkus, even though you live to fight another day, but still, Malkus has something in a core way in common with Misa as the onesh for Avera. So there is a theoretical Misa for every Avera, and somehow Malkus can play that function. even though the person survives. This reminds us of something that we've seen very recently. Or this reminds me of something we've seen very recently. What does this remind you of?
Morty? It's like Shami by Yom Kippur, that like really when a person should deserve death, like whenever he sins, and like
it's a question about the. Yeah, it's interesting how to interpret that. So that's long, so I won't address that right now in the time. But something much more well known and even more recent than Yom Kippur. Are you?
You're referring to Adam, it says that he's supposed to die from the
tree
and doesn't die.
Doesn't remind you of Parshas Bereishis? Right? This is basically the whole dynamic in Parshas Bereishis. You have one mitzvah of the Torah, and God says you violate the Torah the only way you can by eating from the Eitz Hadas, you die. But that seems to be the template, the default punishment for violating God's word is Misa. Now, together with that, we also see that in the case of Adam and Chava, it seems to be that their actual sentence is something different other than immediate death.
It wasn't even Makos.
Sorry?
It wasn't Makos.
No, but you see certain core commonalities here in two ways. One, the concept that violating God's word should always have a Chi of Misa attached to it. And that Chi of Misa theoretically could be commuted into something else.
We say Misa as a substitute for Jagad, the only thing that...
Substitute
Adam,
for what?
As a substitute for Misa, the only thing that Adam proved was that you should be getting exiled for violating...
Maybe we should do Golos instead?
If we're using that as an example, as a template, then the template doesn't prove Adam, it doesn't prove...
Not necessarily. It depends how specific you have to get. And maybe it just means that there is an appropriate punishment, which might be something else, but that we start off with the language of death. That seems to be the conceptual punishment, and whether or not it actually has to take that form, there's some room for it to take something else. But that punishment is a stand-in for death. So just like whatever happened to Adam and Chava is a stand-in for the Chi of Misa that they incurred when they violated God's law, so too any other error really has a Chi of Misa. It just happens to be that Chi of Misa may not actually be fatal. You may have something which is also a bodily punishment, but one that you can come back from.
Certainly, the punishments that they get aren't on exile. It's also they have to work the land. Childbirth.
You're addressing Jacob's question about just how closely do you have to stick to the model.
Right. So there is pain there.
Right.
Is it a punishment that they have to work the land, or as the result of the punishment in exile, that's the result of the punishment is now because of exile, Hashem's given me everything, I can do that?
Yes, that's all a fair question, but I think it still boils down to the fact that you probably don't have to get so specific in the model. That I think that relationship between the one hand the language of the Chi of Misa, and the other hand it actually manifesting itself a little bit differently, is a similar structure. It's essentially what this Rashi says. Like, can you raise your hand?
I was just going to similarly take issue with the proof that in Misa, there goes to, when you talk about Misa and Gemara, we have a clear definition for what that punishment would be.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, Malkoth is a more Mako punishment, whereas in Parashiyat, God said, yes, you'll eat from the tree and you'll die, but what was defined as Misa, you know, in Parashat Parashiyat was never given.
Okay, so that's a fair distinction. Except that I could argue on that a little bit, a couple of ways. First, your kasha then really is on Rashi. It's not just necessarily so much on the comparison to Adam HaRishon, but just whether or not there really can be considered a conceptual link between Malkus and Misa. So theoretically, it could agree with you, except that Misa isn't actually spelled out. Skila is spelled out, Tzreifa is spelled out, and the different forms of Misa. But what Rashi basically says here is that once we have four, we could have five. And once we have different ways for Misa to be carried out, maybe we also have a fifth Misa which isn't fatal. As paradoxical as it sounds, maybe we have a form that also belongs in that list, but just happens to actually let the person go on to live another day. So yeah, it's highly conceptual, but it's a very instructive concept.
Say that maybe even is more connected to humanity than it's like a perfect model, because for the Eitz Hadas, you don't know if like the it's like a lower point, but you don't know if they were like mortal or immortal, because
mm-hmm.
the point of eating from the Eitz Chaim was that they should live forever.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really do that yet, so what was it for the Eitz Hadas? But if that was the person Eitz Hadas, really like, at that point they weren't anything, and God says like you'll eat from the Eitz Hadas and you'll die, so that was true, because in the end of the day he was saying you will eventually die. So when they then get kicked out and then they to die, so there wasn't the immediate misa. There was like a misa resta, that like eventually, at the end of the day, they wouldn't be immortal anymore. They wouldn't be immortal anymore. They would.
Misa resta. You're borrowing the language from the Gemara Matis, which is also relevant, right? So you're saying, therefore, it's a better model or it's a less good model?
It's a better model.
Better model. Okay.
It is misa, just not the exact misa. You're
and the same
spot.
Phrase misa resta, which the Gemara said by mouth.
Okay.
So just in the interest of time, we'll move a little quickly here. We'll have to expand on this a little bit tomorrow, so hopefully the Tuesday schedule should accommodate our finishing up this again, and we can then move on. But Tosfos has two other possibilities, which are also both fascinating, and we'll have to expand on tomorrow. But in the end, Tosfos thinks Rashi, however highly conceptual it might be, Tosfos likes Rashi the best. Right? The last words of Tosfos are, Perish HaKuntras Iker, that Rashi's interpretation comes to the correct interpretation. But Tosfos adds two very different interpretations. One is that we are all at our core, here's a reference to this week's parsha, we are all at our core Bnei Noach. So Bnei Noach are Chayiv Misa for everything, which is a concept maybe we'll also discuss a little bit tomorrow. So the Gemara has the expression later on in Sanhedrin Asarason, Zohi Misason, that every Azhara, every Aveira also carries with it a Chiyuv Misa. So therefore, as Bnei Noach, we should also have the same rule. That whatever Azharas, there are many more Azharas that are given to us than the rest of the Bnei Noach. But if the policy is Azharasan, Zohi Misason, so technically, again, we're Chiyuv Misa for everything. So the fact that Torah tells us, well, hold on, not so fast, you can give Malkus instead, so then it sounds literally that Malkus the Makom Miso Medes, that the default should have been the Zachiyat Misa, except that the Torah came in and said, actually, in this case, it could be Malkus. In this many cases, it could be Malkus. So that answer, even though it's apparently different than Rashi, it's similar to Rashi. It's expressed from a different point of view, and Tosfos considered it different enough to say Rashi's opinion is correct. But this is similar. But the second answer in Tosfos, how you want to count?
It could be that Tosfos means that Bnei Noach, who are not Jews,
mm-hmm.
would normally, every new violation, get Misa.
Right.
But the Jews are a completely different category, and therefore, maybe it could be read like that.
And what's the difference reading it that way?
Meaning it wouldn't be similar to Rashi. Jews are never don't normally get the default as being Misa for every violation. So meaning it would be read as a completely different understanding.
I'm not sure if there's a functional difference in that reading. I mean, the words, I think, lend themselves to both ways. I'm not sure how much of a difference.
When
the seventh is
drawn,
Malkus Azarasso, Tachas Misa.
That's why the question in the Gemara doesn't make any sense.
The question about the Omid.
Yeah.
Okay. Either way, I think it basically boils down to the same thing, that theoretically the default punishment for violating God's world has been shown to be Misa, and Jews are given sometimes the opportunity for Malkus instead. So on that level, it's comparable to Rashi, but it's coming from a different point of view. But the second answer in Tosfos is much more practical. And the second answer in Tosfos is, doesn't have anything to do with the conceptual quality of Malkus, but what's it about? The fact that Malkus are dangerous. Right? Theoretically, somebody could die from the process of receiving Malkus. And if they did, the one who administered that death would not be punished because he would be doing what he's supposed to do. So he'd be pater. So somebody could end up essentially executed accidentally through this process. So therefore, maybe we should have a panel of 23 for that reason. So this... Sorry?
Added risk.
So then it seems to say, what's the idea of 23? That maybe if anybody's life is at stake, one way or another, we should have 23 people on board. That's what it sounds like to me. Now, just one question to think about for tomorrow. We'll recap, and then we'll dive into it. But think about this question. So, is it a machlokes, Rabbi Yishmael and Chachamim, whether or not we say Malchus Mako Miso Medes? Is the truth of that statement a machlokas between Chacham and Rabbi Shmuel?
No.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Right? So we don't know for sure. Not necessarily that I would agree with. But the first way, say Rashi's way, maybe it is. Right? Maybe Rabbi Shmuel is saying, oh, Malchus is a form of Mises, which it had 23. And Rashi is explaining what he means. And Chachamim say, no, it's nothing to do with Misa. And therefore, three are enough. Well, if you say the second way in Tosus, that it's because it's potentially deadly, well, that's a fact. Everyone agrees it's potentially deadly. So if Malchus Mako Miso Medes means that, so then that point is not subject to dispute. So that's just one interesting hard to keep in mind. You can think about that a little bit tomorrow. That the question of whether this statement is unanimously accepted, Malchus Mako Miso Medes, might depend on how you translate the phrase. Now, the Rambam, for example, the Rambam paskins that we need three, not 23. And the Rambam in different places mentions, even though it's dangerous, and even though the person could end up dying, and the Rambam also brings down the phrase, Malchus Mako Miso Medes, which one way of reading our Gemara could have said that that's not consistent with three days. So what exactly the implications of that? So we'll have to pick up on tomorrow. And we'll have to talk a little bit also about what exactly takes place in front of these three and how that affects the different elements here. So just quickly review what we spoke about. So we raised the question of why should we say 3 or 23? We talked about the difference between punishments and non-punishments, between life and death issues and non-life and death issues, between that which is reversible and that which is not reversible, all those different ways to theoretically put Malchus in one bag or the other. Then we talked about when the Mishnah says Malchus v'shlosha, so what does Malchus mean in Halacha? So we saw probably four different things. We saw that it's the default punishment for every single lav with the exception of many of them. We talked about that a little bit. So presumably Mishnah is talking at least about that. But then we talked about a few other possible usages of Malchus. The fact that Makos is the default punishment that it can also replace other punishments. Misa we see here maybe, but also Krisus, as Mishnah says, and that was the reason for the whole Chiddush HaSmicha discussion. We talked about that a little bit. And that also connects to the idea that it's used as a tool of tshuva, and maybe that's the same idea, and there's some sofer is true about that. And also the fact that Makos is used for kriya, to compel mitzvos. But there are some clear differences there. It's only done beforehand and not afterhand, and there it's done for positive mitzvot. And there it's done at Shetei Shenafshel, so there are clearly some differences. So to what extent is that kind of usage relevant in this Mishnah as well? And then we talked about the Gemara here in Daf Yod, where we saw that the Machlokas was explained by the Gemara, either Rabbi Shmuel's position is based on Gzeir Shava, or it's based on the idea of Malchus Mako Miso Medes. Saw three different ways in Rishonim to understand that. We saw Rashi says that really violating God's word is always the fifth Misa, and Malchus is basically like a fifth Misa. And we talked about whether or not that's comparable to the Kriyas HaTorah of this past Shabbos with Adam HaRishon. And then we saw Tosus, which invokes the Kriyas HaTorah was coming Shabbos, the concept of Bnei Noach, Asarasan, Zoe Musasan, so that should be subject to Jews also. So we have Misa, we have Malchus instead, so therefore, literally, Misa, Malchus, B'makom, Misa, Omedes. And the second view of Tosfos is much more practical, that it's about the fact that, theoretically, one could die during this process, and therefore you need a pound of 23 for that reason. And how is that relevant? And then we saw this also affects the question of whether or not the statement of Malchus, B'makom, Misa, Omedes is universally accepted. According to the second view of Tosfos, it's an objective fact. According to Rashi, maybe it is subject to a machlokas or Rishmal and Chachamim. And we see that the Rambam Elisa brings down the fact that it's dangerous. Paskins, he had three dayanim, and also paskins the idea of Malchus Mako Misa Omeda. So we'll pick up with that tomorrow. And now we will dive into it. Ashrei Shevei Sechah, Shulchan Aruch.